From NPR, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. 2 years after the passage of Arizona's immigration enforcement law, the Supreme Court finally gets ready to hear arguments for and against it.
There's a certain element of the Supreme Court as an opaque kind of oracle, and you wait for the word to emerge, kind of like the smoke to come out of the curia when they elect a pope.
Around the country, many people have already made up their minds about the law.
I think it's kind of invasive and going to hurt people that are here legally even.
And a telenovela that takes on diabetes and makes villains out of salty and fatty foods.
Todos los doctores son iguales. Siempre te están tratando de quitar todo lo que uno disfruta en la vida. Que no sal, que no azúcar, que no grasa, que no sabor, nada de nada.
It's a recipe for health coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. But first, this news update. The housing crisis of the last few years hit Latinos and African Americans harder than most other Americans. On average, these groups received higher mortgage rates, faced foreclosure more often, and had fewer resources to resolve their housing issues. Those who managed to hang on to their homes continue to feel the fallout from the crisis. A recent report by four housing groups found that in 8 cities around the country, banks neglected the maintenance and marketing of foreclosed homes that had been taken over in Black and Latino neighborhoods. This has made it harder to resell the properties and to restore these communities. On April 4th, the National Fair Housing Alliance and the four local groups filed a federal fair housing complaint against Wells Fargo, the nation's largest mortgage lender, around these issues. Sarah Ludwig is the founder and executive director of the Neighborhood Economic Development Advocacy Project. She joins us to talk about the complaint and why it matters to recovering from the housing crisis. Sarah, welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you, Maria.
So what was at the heart of the complaint from these housing groups?
So what the housing groups did is really a sort of groundbreaking undercover investigation where they looked at a problem that's national in scope, but they focused on 8 cities across the country. Wells Fargo is the subject of a major federal Fair Housing Act complaint filed by the National Fair Housing Alliance, because through this undercover investigation, what they found was that the bank was maintaining and marketing properties that it had repossessed in predominantly Latino and African-American neighborhoods in a state of disrepair, whereas the homes that they had in possession through the foreclosure process in predominantly white neighborhoods, they were maintaining, they were marketing in a substantially better condition.
So if I own a home in a neighborhood down the street from a foreclosed home, if I live in a predominantly Latino community or African-American community, and there's a foreclosed home that has tall grass growing around it, there's garbage in the front yard, you know, the front door has got a bolt lock on it, how does that affect me if I own a home?
And that's exactly the point of this complaint that the National Fair Housing Alliance filed with HUD, that it's not just about the home being in disrepair, it's about the community impact. And looking at how all of these homes that have been repossessed by banks that are sitting empty, that the banks are failing to repair, to maintain, to market in predominantly Latino and African American neighborhoods, is sort of like the new wave of devastation that's rolling over communities of color. The physical disrepair, the mold, the vermin, the health implications are huge. It has an effect on the entire community because the tax base gets eroded. It's much more likely that when a home falls into disrepair, if the bank is failing to maintain it, it's going to be bought at auction, if it is bought, by an investor who's going to get it at a discount. The more the home falls into disrepair, the more unlikely it is that someone's going to buy the home to live in it. And that's, you know, going to affect the entire community fabric. So, I mean, I could go on and on about the spillover effects that this has, but I think that's really what's at the heart of the lawsuit, is how these practices are having such a discriminatory, degrading effect on communities of color, and it's yet one more blow to neighborhoods that have already borne the brunt of this crisis.
All right, so this complaint focuses on Wells Fargo, the largest mortgage lender, but what's your sense of how widespread this practice might be by other banks?
I mean, this is, you know, the first lawsuit that I know of that uses the Fair Housing Act to show how these practices are discriminatory and having a discriminatory impact. I think that this is absolutely systemic. It is widespread. You have blight and visible degradation of communities throughout the country, particularly neighborhoods of color, as a result of this foreclosure crisis, and banks just not being held accountable to maintain these properties.
So what needs to happen now? What are the next steps?
Well, so HUD has this complaint in front of it, and HUD needs to take direct action against Wells Fargo to deal with this Fair Housing Act violation. You know, the Department of Justice and other entities that deal with the Fair Housing Act and its enforcement can also get involved. We need to hold banks accountable. They've gotten away with far too much for far too long, and the ball is now in HUD's court to act to enforce the law that it's charged with enforcing.
Sarah, thank you for being with us on Latino USA.
Thank you.
Sarah Ludwig is the founder and executive director of the Neighborhood Economic Development Advocacy Project. She spoke to us from New York City. For news updates throughout the week, visit us at latinousa.org or follow us on Twitter. We are LatinoUSA, all one word, and we're back in 30 segundos. That's 30 seconds. Stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. On April 25th, the Supreme Court hears oral arguments on one of the toughest and most restrictive immigration laws in our country. Arizona law, SB 1070, would require local police to check the immigration status of anyone stopped for an alleged offense, no matter how minor. It would make it a state crime for people visiting the U.S. not to carry immigration papers with them at all times. And it would allow people to sue their local governments if the state law or federal immigration law wasn't being enforced. The Arizona legislature passed the law 2 years ago, but a federal court immediately blocked most of its provisions. Now, the Supreme Court is getting ready to decide if the Arizona law should be upheld or if it goes too far. Joining us are Laura Vasquez. She's legislative analyst at the Immigration Policy Project of the National Council of La Raza. And Mark Krikorian. He's the executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies. And both of them are speaking to us from our studios in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Latino USA.
Glad to be here.
Thanks, Maria.
All right. So when the federal court issued its injunction against the Arizona law in 2010, the judge said that Arizona had overstepped its bounds. So, Laura, why don't you remind us of the reasoning behind why the federal judge said that Arizona had essentially overstepped its bounds?
There is a principle in the United States Constitution that there is federal law that preempts state laws, which makes it so that states cannot change federal policy and create their own types of laws. So in this instance, it's to prevent the United States from having a patchwork of different immigration laws.
So, Mark, do you agree with that in the sense of your understanding of why the federal judge said that Arizona had overstepped its bounds?
Sure. The basic point that Laura made is right. In other words, Congress has complete control over immigration. It's called plenary power. In other words, they can do anything they want in immigration, and they can say that states have no authority, or they can say states can do these things but not these things. So the question really is, what has Congress prohibited states and localities from doing in immigration, and what have they not prohibited states from doing? And where that line is really is the main legal issue that I think the Supreme Court's going to be addressing.
All right, Mark. So what do you think are going to be the likely arguments that we're going to be hearing from Arizona, basically refuting this notion that they've overstepped their bounds?
Well, I think the key point Arizona's going to make is that Congress has actually already authorized states and localities to enforce certain parts of immigration law. In 1996, Congress actually created the 287G program for state or local law enforcement to actually work with immigration in helping assist in immigration enforcement. So the point is, states can't say, we're going to take this many immigrants or we're going to deport people. Those are things states can't do. But what they're going to say is that the kind of things that are in SB 1070 are the kinds of things states are permitted to do.
So let me ask about some of the specific parts of the law, because they are going to actually look at separate parts of the law and decide on them. So what parts are most problematic?
Well, there's a couple that I'll raise. One, of course, is the one where individuals, based on the way they look and the way they sound, the way they speak, could be pulled over and asked for their documents. And that's extraordinarily problematic because, I mean, you can't tell based on someone's appearance whether or not they are U.S. citizens or whether they are here on a tourist visa, whether they're students. There's just no way of knowing that. So we find that extremely problematic.
All right. Since SB 1070 in Arizona, there have been several states, including Alabama, South Carolina, Georgia, Utah, which have passed similar laws, and at least 30 other states have considered similar laws. If the main provisions of Arizona's law are upheld, do you expect to see many more similar laws going through, or perhaps even stricter ones? And do you think we're going to start seeing more local ordinances that will affect immigrants? Mark, let's start with you.
I think it's almost certain that if the law is upheld, you'll see attempts in other states to pass it. Obviously, whether it succeeds in any given state will depend on its own political circumstances. You never know what will happen. But sure, some places, a lot of places will debate such measures. Some places will pass them. This issue, though, of patchwork is kind of interesting because if the legislation is upheld, it could well be then that Congress might want to act in order to avoid the very patchwork nature that Laura's talked about.
When you hear that, Laura Vasquez from National Council of La Raza, the possibility that the law will be upheld, the possibility that other states will then follow suit and local ordinances will pop up, what goes on for you?
Well, I think a number of states are already deciding not to follow in the misguided path of Arizona because they have seen the consequences that have taken place in these states. There have been tremendous economic consequences in Arizona. They faced tremendous costs, not just in defending this law, but also with tourism when people decided not to go there. And regardless of the court's decision, I think the states are already looking at this with tremendous skepticism.
And then just finally, your sense of when we might be hearing on this ruling from the Supreme Court, early summer, is that what you understand, Mark?
You know, you never know. I mean, there's a certain element of the Supreme Court is a opaque kind of oracle, and you wait for the word to emerge, kind of like the smoke to come out of the curia when they elect a pope. So yeah, but June is what I understand when we're going to hear about it one way or the other.
We'll be watching for the smoke signals from the Supreme Court then. Thank you so much for joining us. Laura Vasquez is a legislative analyst with the Immigration Policy Project of the National Council of La Raza. Mark Krikorian is executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies in Washington, D.C. They spoke to us from our studios in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Until fairly recently, both major political parties agreed on the need for reform of the nation's immigration laws. But in the past couple of years, there's been a hardening of opinion, and immigration has become a flashpoint. Polls suggest that a majority of Americans support the idea of a state, such as Arizona, having a strong role in immigration enforcement. But when it comes to the particulars of exactly how states will do this, opinions become more complex. We asked people in Louisiana, in Colorado, and around the nation's capital to tell us how they feel about the issue.
My name is Cameron Calderon. I'm from Pueblo, Colorado.
I'm Steve Clark. I'm from Denver.
I'm Maria Sparnas, and I'm from New York City, New York.
And I'm Allison from Florida.
My name is Alan. I'm from Alabama.
And I'm Arbet Alexander, and I'm from Denver, Colorado.
And I'm against the immigration law.
Why?
Oh, it's discriminatory. That's why.
I think it's kind of invasive and going to hurt people that are here legally even. You know, it's pretty discriminatory maybe. And how would you, you know, what would be the reasons for stopping someone? And
I didn't know it was actually called what you called it. I just heard it was like the green card law. That's what I heard it. But like they pull you over and if like you don't have your birth certificate or anything on you, then they automatically think you're an illegal citizen, which is ridiculous. I mean, I carry my birth certificate on me anyways, but still, it's crazy.
I kind of think we need it. You know, it's kind of sad, but because it seems like we're getting overpopulated and, you know, we can't find jobs here half the time.
Oh, it makes me feel more threatened. It could be a slippery slope. I mean, you know, I'm as white as they get, so I don't feel all that threatened right now by anything like that, but, you know, where does it end?
I don't think it does anything for security. The economy is getting worse, so somebody's going to be blamed. So what's the easiest way to blame? Hey, blame the immigrants.
I feel it's a manipulation of one group's freedoms, and that means that no group is safe.
Does legislation like Arizona's make you feel more secure or more threatened?
Neither. It just makes us feel like we're wasting money.
I mean, the state should enforce the state laws, and, you know, we got FBI, whoever enforced the federal law, so.
We have two separate law agencies for that purpose. We don't need them to cross boundaries. I think it can easily be twisted to serve your own purpose.
Anyone who's in any kind of law enforcement has some kind of obligation to enforce any law, whether it's national or local or state law. Yeah, that's, I think it trickles down that way. That's kind of the idea.
It's the law. I mean, they should have the authority to enforce the law. They earned that right.
Everyone should stay within their jurisdiction. That's how we work together as a country, when everyone does their part. Local police should stay within the confines of their jurisdiction, just stick to what they're supposed to do, enforcing the laws locally, and allow the federal police to control the immigration.
Using the police to enforce an immigration policy is not appropriate, and I just think it's really counterproductive.
Why?
If you are an undocumented worker and you have a problem, you're certainly not going to go to the police. And anyway, legally, I don't think there's any basis to them to be carrying out arrests due to immigration status.
National ID? That's another waste of money, because you already got to pay the state ID. Like, what else do they want? You know? So
it's really just a way of cataloging all of us, whether I'm here legally or not. The whole idea of being documented that way, I think, is... I feel kind of violated. I mean, I feel violated when I, you know, when I apply for a mortgage or a credit card and they run my background check. I feel violated by stuff like that. I'm really kind of scared about really anything along those lines that would have me profiled, databased, anything like that. Freaks me out.
Bad idea. In fact, it's you know, the only people that's hurting it is us, the people that live there.
Personally, I don't care who's here for whatever reason. So the whole immigration issue for me goes much deeper than who broke the law, who climbed what fence to get over here.
I've had people be rude to me in stores when I've asked a question about a price because they've just made the assumption that I'm a foreigner or something like that.
My best friend is white-skinned Venezuelan. She went to high school with me, and she was unable to get loans to go to college because she wasn't technically a citizen.
People sometimes do approach me speaking Spanish or other languages. I guess I could be approached by the police wanting to see my papers, and I just think that's an example of how they're going to be doing stuff. It's all about racial profiling.
I'm Caucasian, and I know that there's a whole conversation that other demographics have to have with their children, that there is such a thing as white privilege. Whether we want to talk about it or not, there is white privilege. You know, other people from other families, from other backgrounds have to have the conversation about, you know, that it's basically illegal to drive while black in some places, so, or drive while Hispanic, or you know, be in the wrong community in the red, you know, with the wrong color skin. I mean, that's just, you know, a sad fact of our culture.
No, I just have a lot of friends who are not here legally from Mexico, so I probably shouldn't say that, huh? So I have a heart for people that are just working really hard.
And coming up in 1 minute, can a telenovela be more than idle entertainment? One Spanish language soap opera helps people with diabetes learn how to manage their disease by dishing out delicious, healthy recipes, along with good advice. That's coming up on Latino USA. No se vayan. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Latinos, together with African Americans and Native Americans, face a higher risk of diabetes than the general population. At the same time, many Latino patients, especially those with lower incomes, don't get enough information from medical professionals about how to prevent or manage the disease. To help remedy this, a professor at the University of Massachusetts Medical School came up with an innovative program to teach people about diabetes. It all starts with a telenovela, a soap opera. Amy Mayer has our report.
Libra. Hoy es tu día.
Milagros Rosal and her colleagues developed Retos para una Vida Saludable, or The Challenge of Being Healthy, and had it professionally produced using bilingual actors.
Todos los doctores son iguales. Siempre te están tratando de quitar todo lo que uno disfruta en la vida. Que no sal, que no azúcar, que no grasa, que no sabor, nada de nada. ¿Cómo uno puede vivir sin sal, azúcar y un poquito de grasa?
El doctor que me In it, a mother and daughter argue about doctors and about eating and cooking habits. The mother has diabetes and wants her daughter to avoid it. The daughter doesn't think it's preventable and says she can cook and eat the way she always has until she gets the disease. Over the 12 episodes, the daughter's attitude changes.
Yo no creo que ayuda. Yo no tengo síntomas de nada ni me siento enferma.
A simple story with a meaningful message. In Rosal's study, more than 300 Latino adults watched the novela in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Carmen Colasso is one of the 312 study participants. She already had diabetes when she was recruited for the study.
I was in a bad place, depressed. I had type 2 diabetes. It was going to be hard. It was going to be traumatic for me.
But she's not depressed anymore. From the telenovela, she learned two life-changing things. First, you can prevent diabetes. And second, for those who already have it, the game's not over. In fact, it's just begun.
I learned a lot from the video. They teach you how to deal with your health in this disease, that it's not curable, but you can control it.
Professor Rosal says familiar stories resonate with people. That's why study participants, like Carmen Colasso, retained messages delivered in the novela and took them to heart. Rosal says, once patients have heard a message in a way that makes it personal and in a format they're familiar with, they are often open to more information.
Another very important component of the intervention was a food guide that was picture-based and included foods that people eat, as well as foods that we had learned over the years that people were amenable to eating or trying new.
Carmen Colasso says she discovered olive oil as a replacement for butter, that tuna makes healthier burgers than beef, and that it's okay to have a treat once in a while, but to keep the portion small.
I loved it all. I loved learning to cook the linguine with zucchini, the salad with feta and vinegar. They gave us portions to try and the recipe to take home.
She toted around her food guide and shared it with friends and family as far away as Puerto Rico. A community health clinic and the YWCA also participated in the diabetes prevention program. Rosal says the results were surprising.
So what we learned is that people lost a moderate amount of weight. On average, it was only 2.5 pounds. However, the findings in terms of insulin resistance and hemoglobin A1C levels, which is a measure of glucose in the blood, were quite significant clinically and statistically.
In other words, after losing just 2.5 pounds, Latinos significantly reduced their diabetes risk. The insulin resistance and hemoglobin measurements occurred with much less weight loss than in the general population study Rosal based the Lawrence Project on. Those participants had to lose an average of 12 pounds to get the same results. Carmen Colasso says she would love to help with another study. For now, she continues to share what she's learned about calories, protein, salt, and sugar. Recently, she saw a friend crying over a diabetes diagnosis.
No tienes que llorar.
You don't need to cry, I told her. You'll learn to live with it, I said. What you have to do is quit smoking, I told her, and begin little by little to change your diet. You can eat everything, but in small portions, not the whole plate. and I'll teach you to measure your food.
Carmen Collazo is a good role model. She's gone from two sugars in her coffee to one sugar substitute. And the best part, she isn't missing her old ways at all. For Latino USA, I'm Amy Mayer, Lawrence, Massachusetts.
Our story on diabetes education was one of our health heroes profiles, part of our year-long series on Latinos and health. And to end our show this week, well, April is National Poetry Month, and a national project called NaPoWriMo, short for National Poetry Writing Month, has since 2003 challenged poets to write a poem each day of the month and to share them. New York-based poet Rich Villad is participating in the project and shared with us the poem he wrote for the second day of the challenge. He titled it Testimonio Número Dos.
She dreams color. She dreams Williamsburg before aging hipsters. She dreams the Eagles unplugged on the soundtrack. She dreams cruel worlds and a daughter who tames them. She dreams dark chocolate hazelnut ridiculous kiss. She dreams thousands of keyboards and fingers. She dreams home, friends, amor, wine, and laughter. She dreams 1 minute longer. She dreams Tuscany. She dreams Abuela's smile. She dreams me when she's not looking. She dreams in Bossa Nova. She dreams family in every frame. She dreams peace, peace, peace. She dreams the Greca's elixir every morning. She dreams sand. She dreams grass. She dreams a stamped passport. She dreams cuatro nights. She dreams universes spinning at her fingertips. She dreams ink and good paper. She dreams me happy. She dreams me happy. She dreams, and I want sleep. If sleep is the bridge I must cross to her door.
And for this week, that's Latino USA. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Nadia Raymond, Andres Caballero, and Michael Jones. We had special help this week from Michael Johnson, Melanie Bucos, and NPR New York. Latino USA is produced by The Futuro Media Group. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Our year-long look at Latinos in health is made possible by funding from Pfizer. With Pfizer Helpful Answers, a family of patient assistance programs for patients in need, at PfizerHelpfulAnswers.com.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org. And Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring with a Floor Finder app for iPad and iPhone. Learn more at lumberliquidators.com. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.